Hello, everyone. I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm interviewing Tiffany Rice, the author of The Night Mark. Historians, historical novelists, and readers of historical fiction love to imagine going back into the past. In a sense, that's what historical fiction is, a kind of time travel. But those of us who write it, and no doubt read it, always wonder if we got it right. In this novel, set along the South Carolina coast, Faye Barlow has a chance to experience the past firsthand. When we first meet her, though, she has a different kind of time travel on her mind. Faye closed her eyes and thought of Casablanca. Easy to do, since she'd been watching it earlier that day. She'd also watched the week before and the month before that. In the past 3 years, she watched it about 10 times. Maybe more. But 10 is all she would admit to if asked. And her husband had asked when he'd come home from work and found her watching it. "Again?" Hagen said. "It's a classic," was all Faye had said. And because Hagen knew better, he hadn't said anything else. Faye closed her eyes and thought of Casablanca, because Hagen was kissing the back of her neck. Friday night, 9 o'clock, the 1 hour of the week she usually made the effort to show up for her marriage. But she hadn't felt well all day, tired, aching, and all she wanted to do was close her eyes and go to sleep. Since she couldn't sleep, she dreamed of Rick and Ilse and Morocco, while Hagen did his best to pretend theirs was a real marriage. Faye knew better by now. She'd been worried about Rick for 3 years. Had Rick ever found someone else to love? Or if he'd made a monk of himself, living in celibate devotion to Ilse for the rest of his life? Or maybe he died shortly after Ilse got on that plane, killed by fascists or Nazis on his way to Brazzaville with Louis. Faye hoped he died. Better that than to live for decades still in love with Ilse, still in love with a woman he could never have again. Whoever first said it was better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, clearly had never loved or never lost. And now, please join me in welcoming Tiffany Rice. Hi, Tiffany. I look forward to talking with you today.
Oh, thanks for having me here, Carolyn. I'm really excited to be on the podcast.
We're delighted to have you. You have a long list of books that cover quite a wide range, from very steamy romances to The Bourbon Thief, which is a family saga with elements of mystery and suspense. So tell us about your writing career before The Night Mark.
Well, I write for Mira Books, which is the mainstream fiction imprint of Harlequin. And Harlequin, as we know, is synonymous with romance. So my first book series is sort of an erotic, steamy soap opera called The Original Sinners. When that series ended after 8 books, which was always the plan, a good nice, round, fat number, 8 books, it was time to write something different. I'd written a romance, a gothic romance called The Headmaster, which is a classic gothic, spooky boarding school, maybe ghosts, maybe not ghosts. And it was so much fun to just dive into the gothic elements of a story that was set in the past that I wanted to do it again. So I wrote a book called The Bourbon Thief, which is Southern Gothic. I live in Kentucky and I do a lot of traveling in the South. Places like coastal South Carolina are very much have 1 foot in the past and 1 foot in the present. So The Bourbon Thief was set partly in Kentucky and partly on an island on the South Carolina coast. And I loved writing the mythology for this island. There are a lot of tiny islands on the South Carolina coast, and some of them are private islands. One is, I think it's called something like Monkey Island, where like research monkeys only live. So it's a really weird place that not many people are familiar with. A nice spooky place with an interesting history. So I wanted to go back to that island that was in The Bourbon Thief, which led me to wanting to write The Night Mark, because we are all quite familiar with lighthouses being on coastal islands. So they tied well together. So The Night Mark came after The Bourbon Thief, and although they're both standalones, they have some connections to each other.
Ah, so that's interesting. So that answers my next question, which is how you got to The Night Mark. Is there something in particular about lighthouses that appeals to you?
I've always loved them. When you're near one, you can't stop looking at them. I lived briefly in Oregon, So going from Kentucky to Oregon, where there were mountains in the distance, we could see Mount Hood and sometimes Mount St. Helens. When you're driving, you just can't stop looking at them. You just keep glancing into the distance. And lighthouses are the same way. If there's one anywhere near you, that's where your eye is always drawn. And they're so symbolic of the past because we don't really need them anymore. We have GPS and buoys and the sort of thing that keeps us from our ships from getting lost and into wrecks. But they were these monuments of a past that's romantic in theory, maybe not as romantic in reality. But what happened was my husband and I were on vacation in Savannah, Georgia, and we heard the story. We were on one of those $2 tours of town, and we heard the story of Florence Martis, who's a local legend in Savannah. She was the lighthouse, Cockspur Island's lighthouse keeper's sister. So she kept house for her brother, who was the lighthouse keeper. And the local legend is that she fell in love with a sailor who shipped out. This was very early 20th century, who shipped out, and she started to wait for him to come back. They were engaged. She was waiting for her fiance to come back and claim her. And so she would start to, she started to greet every ship that came into the port of Savannah by waving like a white flag by day and a lantern by night. And she always had her little dog with her. And she became the symbol of hospitality as she waited for her fiance to come back to her. And the sad thing is he never returned. She did this all her life until she retired, and now there's a statue of her, and she's a symbol of hospitality, Southern hospitality. But when my husband and I heard this story, Andrew's also a writer, we kind of looked at each other and went, oh, she made him up. She totally made him up. She didn't want to get married for whatever reason, so she invented a fake fiance, like the Canadian girlfriend, the sort of beard fiance, so she wouldn't have to get married for whatever reason, because this is how the writer brain works. You're always looking for plot twists. So that idea stuck with me and ended up becoming the Nightmark, a woman who claims to have a fiance who doesn't exist.
That's great. So I do see the connections there to the story, and I won't go into them too much because it really becomes clear towards the end of the story. We want people to read the book and find out. But so you started with this story, and how do you get to your main character, Faye? When did she come into the story?
She was the first person I thought of for this story, other than, of course, a lighthouse keeper. If you're going to travel back in time and spend time with a lighthouse keeper, you have to have him. But it takes an unusual person in unusual circumstances who goes into the past and wants to stay there. I think 99.9% of us would enjoy our trip into the past, but we would not want to stay in a time before antibiotics and in a time before women's liberation, especially women, in a time where there was rampant segregation. So for my character of Faye, I had to basically make her life miserable in the present. So it's much more understandable why she is so drawn to this past world where she has to give up so many modern conveniences, but find something in the past that's not what she has in the present. So it was very quick idea that she would be a widow who was still grieving for her husband. I started writing the Nightmark right after I got married. So in a way, it's sort of a tribute to happy marriage and how much joy that can bring to your life when you're happily married, like I am. But now, once you are happily married, losing your spouse becomes one of your biggest fears. I try not to dwell on sort of things like, you know, one of these days I know my cat will die, I might outlive my husband. These are the things that keep me up at night that I try not to dwell on. But while I was writing the Nightmark, and every time Faye thinks about her husband, Will, who died a few years earlier, I just cried and cried. I wanted to give her happiness so badly because I felt her pain so much. But that's where she came from. Was like, I have to have a very special type of character who it makes sense that she would be okay giving up her iPhone and central air conditioning.
That's great. And as you say, I mean, you have to make her miserable at the beginning so that she can be happy by the end. But she's actually, even though she's mourning her first husband, Will, she's actually remarried when we met her to Hagen, and that's not going so well. Can you tell us about that part of the setup?
I I worry a lot about not just women, but I was in student loan debt for a very, very long time. Luckily, my books took off enough to get out of student loan debt. But it was a chain around my neck for years. And I have never forgotten. There were moments where I was like, I would marry a total stranger to get out of student loan debt. If a man promised to get me out of student loan debt, I would marry him. And I would be a very good wife to him for the rest of my days. Luckily, it didn't come to that. But it made sense to me that a woman who was in such dire financial straits as Faye would latch on to someone who was offering her this lifeboat, this life preserver. When you're drowning, you cling to the first thing that's thrown your way, which was this Guy Hagen, who was her husband's best friend. And it was it made sense at the time. But of course, a marriage that starts out that way is probably not going to be particularly successful. But I don't like writing villains, which I was glad Hagen didn't turn into a villain. He's just not, you know, they're just an incompatible married couple. As Faye says to one of the other characters in the book, her late husband Will loved her so much more than she'd ever been used to being loved, and it's very hard to go back to being loved the normal amount when you are loved more than you feel like you deserve, when you are spoiled. She was spoiled by how happy she was, so it's very hard to go back to a much more normal way of doing things.
Yeah, I really had the impression, I mean, Hagen is not a bad guy in any way. I mean, but his main flaw, as far as I could tell, was that he wasn't Will.
Yes. Yeah. And it's unfair to ask someone to be someone who they are not, which I think is the foundation of a lot of marriages that end up failing. I have friends who, of course, I have a bunch of writer friends, and many of them started writing after they got married. And so some spouses are like, oh, sure, that's something my wife is doing now. She's writing romance novels. That's great. It's extra income. It's fun. She likes it. And then some spouses are like, why are you doing this? This is not what I signed up for. You going to writers' conferences all the time. You being stuck in your office working until 2 a.m. This is not the person I married. So there is trying to turn your spouse into someone they aren't, or expecting them to be someone they aren't, or not allowing them to grow and change is a foundation of a lot of divorces. And I had been in those sorts of relationships before, so luckily I did not get married to any of those people. But that feeling of being with somebody who wants me to be someone I'm not has always just stuck with me. So I'm very sympathetic to Hagen, but also to Faye, who was, you know, doing her best in a terrible situation.
Yes, no, I understand what you're saying. I mean, when I started writing novels, I did it for fun, and I had never, ever, ever intended to write fiction. And so my husband is one of those people. I mean, he is fortunately one of the people who just kind of goes, okay, so my wife is writing novels now. But, you know, there is this little part where he just says, well, aren't you a historian? And it's
like, yes.
Yes, of course I am that too.
But yeah, no. I'm glad Andrew and I met after we both had book deals. So this is how we know each other.
but it is a certain kind of, I mean, fortunately he's very accepting, but I could imagine that it could be very difficult if you had a spouse who was not. And for Faye and Hagen, which is where we started with this, it's really, I mean, they're both grieving, really. They both lost this person. And so they're kind of drawn together in part by their affection for this other person. And then, of course, in Faye's case, as you mentioned, it's in her, you know, she needs health insurance. She's pregnant and she can't support herself. And so that's another element in the marriage, because when you're in financial stress, you know, that seems like the most important thing in the world. But then she marries Hagen and that part of it is taken care of. And now she's got to deal with the next level, which is,
oh, now we're married.
Yeah, right. So now I have health insurance.
Yes.
Who is this guy that I've hung out with?
Yeah, I remember it was, when would this have been? 12 years ago, dating someone without health insurance, and I had it. And I said, do you just want to get married? You need health insurance. You're going to the doctor all the time. You're going to go bankrupt if you don't get health insurance. Let's just get married so you can get on mine. He was like, I'm not going to get married for health insurance. But I know people who did. I know people who did. I have friends now. They were in love and living together, but they got married long before they had their official wedding because her health insurance dropped her. And she had to marry her fiance, you know, a year before they had planned on it, just so she wouldn't go bankrupt with doctor's bills. So it is a real thing that happens.
I was also sort of mentally laughing when you were talking about it because, of course, marrying, you know, the first person who asks you, even if it's a stranger, is a classic romance plot.
It is, and I wanted to show that it's a lot harder in the real world than it is in books. I read a wonderful Georgette Heyer novel that somebody said, that doesn't sound like a romance at all. I forgot the name of it, but it was a marriage of convenience. He was a good guy, but his family was in debt, so he had to marry a woman with money. He wasn't attracted to her, and at no point did they ever really fall in love in the book. They just became friends and decided to work well together. Somebody said, that doesn't sound like a romance at all. It's like, no, but it is much more likely how a marriage of convenience is going to work out in the real world. It was much more realistic. Yeah, a civil contract.
Yeah, it's my absolutely favorite Heyer. I mean, there were times when I didn't like it as much, but I'm a rabid Georgette Heyer fan.
Oh, she's so wonderful.
Her characterizations are just amazing. And I think she wrote that one when she was somewhat depressed, actually, in the 60s or something. Maybe she'd lost her husband or something. Something wasn't going right in her life, and she wrote this book. But it's so much more real than all of the others. It, as much as I love the characterization, I mean, the relationships themselves don't really seem like anything that real people would engage in. But this one is, everybody's very sympathetic, everybody's charming, and it just takes them a long time to get over these very real cultural factors that separate them.
Yes, yes, it's a fantastic book. So that sort of stuck with me, this idea of like, oh, how would... And let's throw away the romance conventions where everybody falls in love by the end. What would a marriage of convenience look like if, for example, I had to be in one? It's like, well, you would kind of have to treat it like a business. It's like, all right, we're a team. We're not in love with each other, but we're coworkers. So we're going to make this business of us work. And in Faye and Hagen's case, it didn't work out so much, but there's no hard feelings, which I really appreciated in a civil contract, which is, you know, we're going to make this work. We're going to find a way. There's a lot of respect.
Yeah, no, that's great. So, so because of all of this that's going on, I mean, because of, Faye has not just lost her husband, but she's lost him in a very dramatic, unsuspected way because they were both very young, and it was very sudden. It was, I don't know how much you want to say about the circumstances, but it's something that's totally unexpected. And then she's in this difficult relationship, and she's drowning, basically. I mean, but long before she gets to the island,
she's metaphorically drowning.
Metaphorically
she's literally drowning,
right? Yeah. Exactly. So, talk to us just a little bit about Will, who he is, who he was before the story starts, because his characteristics do become important as we get into the larger part of the story.
Well, I'm a huge baseball fan, and I wanted to write a baseball romance for a long time, and it just never seemed to happen. What was interesting about Will as I was writing was he didn't exist in the original concept of the book. I knew Faye would be miserable for whatever reason in a bad marriage, but it wasn't until I was writing the rough draft and she's gotten divorced from Hagen. This is always already in like just the second chapter. It happens very quickly. And Hagen calls her to check on her, and he says they're having this argument. They're sort of dancing around something as I'm writing it. And I was like, there has to be more here. There has to be more to this heartbreak of hers than just it was a bad marriage and there's infertility issues that end up pushing them apart. There has to be more. There has to be something deeper, a deeper level to her grief that has made her you know, make this desperate. I'm getting out of this marriage right now. It's the middle of the night and I'm walking out. And just out of nowhere, Hagen says, I was never going to be Will, and it was unfair of you to ever want me to be him. And as soon as I wrote that, I was like, who's this guy? Who's this guy? I was like, is this an ex-boyfriend? What? Who is he? And then I was like, oh, so she was married before and her husband died and she's still in love with him. Okay, that makes sense. I knew Faye was miserable, but I wasn't sure why until she and Hagen got into their phone fight. And then he came out of nowhere. And earlier in the first draft, there was a line, something like three balls is a strike. And four balls three is a strike and four balls is a walk. And so Faye had her fourth big traumatic incident with Hagen. And so the line was Faye walked. It's like, okay, so I have in the first chapter a baseball reference. Why would, not to be sexist, I'm a woman who's a baseball fan, but why is a woman in the middle of fighting with a guy who is like a computer programmer? Why is she making baseball references in her head? I was like, oh, well, Will played baseball. I love reading about the backstories of actual baseball players. And so many of them are just these really interesting, oddly wonderful, heroic, oddball men baseball players are. Now, some are terrible guys. We know not all athletes are heroes, even if they're really good at their sport. But you've got like Javi Baez on the Cubs, whose sister died. Her sister was his best friend, and she died when she was like 21 or 22 years old. And he plays every game in her honor, and he's got a tattoo of her on her arm, and it's so sweet. And he almost couldn't play baseball anymore. He misses his sister so much. So I read the backstories of baseball players, and they're all these sweet young guys who are just so happy to be there. Once they get to the majors, they're like, this is their childhood, their boy dream come true. So I needed a character who it was believable, that A, they would be kind of young and poor. Somebody that Faye, who's a photographer, would meet. She does sports photography for a local newspaper. Minor league players don't make any money. This guy who's this like symbol of like the good boy next door, who's just madly in love with his girlfriend and then later his wife.
For me, that's my favorite part of writing is the stuff that comes up that you never even knew was there. Nothing that was never in the outline that just kind of appeared.
Yes.
It's a wonderful story about Will.
Yeah, it was just they were fighting and he's, you know, I've lost count of the amount of times I'm writing dialogue and a character will say something I hadn't planned on them to say. And then the book goes off in a completely different direction. So then Will showed up and he shows up in conversations that Faye has in her head with him. As soon as she's out on her own, she feels like she can start mourning him because she got married so quickly after he died because she felt she had to, that she never allowed herself to mourn. So finally, when she's on her own, she can deal with her grief, and she deals with it by having these conversations with him in her head that were a lot of fun to write and made me cry every time I wrote them. Every time. Every
sure.
time Will shows up, the waterworks start.
So let's talk about Faye on her own. She leaves Hagen because she is, as you mentioned, a photographer, and she gets a photography gig. She hasn't been photographing while she's been with Hagen, and now that this is really her first move away back into her old self, we could say.
Yes. I have a friend who's a professional photographer, and I admire that skill and the art of it. It's something I wanted to do when I was younger and was terrible at. So, you know, when you are a writer, you can create characters who are good at stuff that you're bad at and live vicariously through them, and it's a lot of fun. For me, as a professional writer, I tell people all the time, because writing is my full-time job, if I do not write, I do not eat. I have to write books. It is the only thing that pays the bills. And there's something terrifying about that and something incredibly liberating about it. You feel strong because you are paying your own bills with your art. And it's a wonderful, liberating feeling but also terrifying. So it's both. And I wanted Faye to have that experience again. She's out on her own and she knows I have to do this job because I have no husband to support me anymore. And I, you know, my husband's a writer too. So he's in the same boat. If he doesn't write, he doesn't eat. So it's not a hobby anymore. It's not something she can leave and walk away from. She has to do it. You know, I've had people who say, how do you write when there's chaos in the news? And how do you write when you're tired? And how do you keep showing up at your desk every day and writing every day? How do you write 4 books a year? It's like, I have to. It's my job. You show up to your job as a teacher or a plumber every day. It's just a job. So that's how you do it. So it was fun to get Faye back into that situation where she's taking care of herself financially and then is also finds herself taking care of herself emotionally too.
So her photography takes her off on a tour of the South Carolina coast, islands in particular, camera in hand. And she ends up in, I assume it's pronounced Beaufort.
Beaufort, believe it or not. Now, somebody who's not from South Carolina tried to correct me. I was like, she said, it's not pronounced like that. I was like, well, in North Carolina, it's Beaufort. But in South Carolina, it's Beaufort. There's two Beaufort's, one in North Carolina and one in South Carolina. And I was like, I'm a Kentuckian. We got Versailles, Kentucky. Versailles, not Versailles, Versailles. So I understand this is a very Southern thing to butcher foreign pronunciations.
Oh, I'm not sure it's only Southern. I mean, think of Isle of Ho in Maine. Oh, and don't get me started on the Scots. I mean,
we'll be here all day.
Right. So, okay. So she's in Beaufort. And she stays in house with Miss Lizzie and a college boy named Ty. And for a moment there, things are looking up.
Yes, yes. It was fun to send her into a house because Beaufort, South Carolina is beautiful. And it's a small town and it seems like every house is 150 years old. I always love books with a fun, diverse cast of characters. And this is South Carolina. So you're going to have, like, it's a large black population in coastal South Carolina. So it was fun to have this sort of pampered, white lady, living in a house that was mostly black people. And she's trying to be on her best behavior because she wants them to think well of her. You know, she meets Ty, who's a student. She wants to go out on his boat, and she has her first flirtation post-divorce, which was a lot of fun to write. I hear the fun horror stories of people who have to go on the dating scene after divorce. So I wanted to make it a little easy on Faye. It's not a love connection, but I let her have a little fun. She needs it.
I have to tell you, the thought of the dating scene will keep a lot of people married.
Yes, I told someone if I ever lost my husband, I've already got my convent picked out that I'm joining. I'm not doing the dating thing. I'm just going to go be a nun somewhere.
Good idea. So thank God for good marriages. That's all I can say.
I tell my husband and my cats they're not allowed to die.
Right. There you go. So the first sign of change to come is that Faye encounters a stork. That seems to take a personal interest in her. At least it shows up on several occasions. So this is obviously a kind of literary thing. What is the meaning of the stork?
Well, we know that the stork is, you know, for 100 years now, it's been a symbol of a baby coming, which is kind of, a little bit, Faye takes it as rather ironic because she's struggled to get pregnant and stay pregnant and hasn't been, wants to have children and has infertility issues. So she's a little insulted but intrigued by his presence. I had an experience in college where there was this one particular crow, this giant crow that seemed to show up anywhere I went on campus. And he was bigger than the other ones and very, very vocal. And I was like, what did I ever do to you? Why are you everywhere? Now, of course, I was just, you know, everybody would see him everywhere, but it felt personal. I wanted to, I wanted the stork to be a harbinger maybe not necessarily of doom, but, you know, it's the beginning of things are starting to get weird. We're starting to get out of Kansas and getting a little closer to Oz. Plus the stork has, there are different versions of mythology that, in ancient Egyptian mythology, the stork or a similar looking bird would carry the soul of the dead, on flights around the world and bring it back to relatives still alive. So there's a hint that this stork might be carrying Will's soul, or at least, you know, Faye has that thought, especially since there was a bird, similar looking bird, when she was spreading Will's ashes in the ocean. So it's sort of a friend, sort of a harbinger.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because I said something about Faye being pregnant, but she actually lost that child after she married Hagen, which was another issue between them, was that she couldn't have kids, or yes, she had not succeeded in having kids by the time they realized that they needed to go separate ways. I had thought also, I think maybe in some traditions, the stork is a symbol of life as well. But in any case, it's just a lovely image that shows up in this kind of literary way. So I wanted to ask what it meant for you. So Faye then learns about two lighthouses in the area. And this is where we're starting to get, you know, seriously into the, we're getting past the first stage of the plot and moving into the main story. So one is on Hunting Island, and another more mysterious lighthouse that no longer operates is located on a private island, which the locals call Bride Island and everyone else calls Seaport Island. And so Ty takes Faye out to the lighthouses by boat, which is where she learns the difference between day marks and night marks. So I thought, since that's your title, I'd ask you to explain it before we get further into the story.
Oh, sure. The day mark is the lighthouse's paint job. Historically, every lighthouse in an area would have a different day mark, a different paint job, and that was used for navigation by day. If you saw the black and white diamond lighthouse, you would know you were at a certain part of North Carolina, and the stripes would be 50 miles down. So that was just for navigation. And also, at night, you can't see the paint job, obviously, so lighthouses would flash their lights in different patterns, and the captain of a ship would know that, like, a five-second flash meant you were at this part of the coast, and a 10-second flash would be a different part of the coast. Both different forms of navigation. But the night mark becomes symbolic in the book of heartbeat, of soul. The night mark of the lighthouse is the lighthouse's soul, the pattern of its light. And Faye looks at people as having a night mark as well, as a light within them. And you can tell people from other people by the light within them.
It's a great way of thinking about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Faye starts doing some research on Bride Island because she's drawn in ways she can't explain by the lighthouse there. And she goes to the Buford Historical Society and sees a painting that especially appeals to her and pulls her in, of a lighthouse and a woman standing at the end of the pier. And this this painting then leads her to Father Pat Cahill, who in turn shows her photographs of the lighthouse keeper, who turns out to look just like Will. And so tell us about this part of the story. What happens next and who the woman is? I mean, this is where we start to hook into the story that drew you to this novel in the first place.
Right. So most people have gotten the internet forwarder, seen the article going around of celebrities, historical people who look like celebrities. So like a certain president looks like, you know, from 200 years ago, looks like Alec Baldwin or something like that. So people have doppelgangers, historical figures who look just like modern people. And that's sort of always stuck with me. It's like, do I have one? Somebody from 200 years ago looks just like me. I had the idea that what will really cement Faye's fascination with this lighthouse is learning that the man who was the keeper of the lighthouse, the Bright Island Light, in the early 1920s, looked just like her late husband, Will. And this fascinates her and draws her deeper into the mystery and creates an obsession. you know, who is he? Is he a relative? Is he a prior incarnation of her husband? She doesn't know, but she desperately wants to know. And I could sympathize. I had a breakup with a boyfriend years ago, and there's a guy in town who looks just like him. And I would run into him at places. And it was like, I became fascinated with, who is this guy who looks just like my ex-boyfriend? So I can see that seeing somebody who looks like her late husband would really get its claws into her, and she wouldn't be able to think about much else, especially as she's going through this fresh mourning period. And while I was in South Carolina researching, I saw somebody painting en plein air out in the open, and just sort of stayed with me. It was like, well, that would be a cool character to have in a book. It's good to have a mentor figure, someone older and wiser. And I'm Catholic, and I like older. I like hanging out with priests and talking to them. So we have a retired priest in Buford who's painting in his retirement, and there are hints that he knows more about this whole situation than he's telling. But as he's a priest, he can't tell everything. He's under obligation to keep some secrets. So Faye and Pat sort of bond. And she ends up giving him her confession, not of sin, but of sorrow. And eventually he helps her get out to the lighthouse, and which leads to her traveling back in time to 1921.
Right. And so in 1921, she runs into the lighthouse keeper, who's a man named Carrick Morgan, and tell us about him as a person. At first, she thinks of him as being another Will, but she gradually realizes that he's his own person.
Yes, he. When I think about the past, even the recent past. Now, you know, my grandparents were alive in the 1920s, so it may feel ancient, but it really is just three generations ago for me anyway. But sometimes it just astonishes me how anybody survived that time. There were cars, but no rules of the road, no stop signs or no stoplights, and people died in car accidents constantly, and no antibiotics. So it just amazes me that anybody survived that time. So you have to wonder what kind of person who goes through all those tragedies, what they would be like. So Carrick is a very resilient guy. He's older than Will would have been, so he's in his mid-30s. A lot of men came back from World War I and then did get jobs working as lighthouse keepers. As Carrick says in the book, they want they'd rather have seamen than landmen, because you know, a sailor knows that if the light goes out on the lighthouse at night, then somebody might die. Whereas somebody who's lived all their life on the land doesn't realize how serious it is. So he's an old sailor. He's seen the world. He's been around the world a couple times. He's open-minded, broad-minded, but also a man of deep faith. And the lighthouse is symbolic in the Bible. There's mention of lighthouses in the Bible, and a light on a hill as a symbol for wisdom and the path you should take and God. So he's a deeply religious man, as a lot of lighthouse families were. They felt like they were doing God's work by protecting people at sea. So he's a good guy who survived a lot of loss, just like Faye.
And Faye is now living in the body of a young woman, Faith Morgan, who is supposedly Carrick's daughter. And we do find out more about her. I don't know how much you want to tell us about her past, but it's there are a number of interesting things about that. I mean, Faye is now much younger and in the body of Faith Morgan, so there's a much greater age difference between Faith and Carrick than there is in reality. And she's hiding out, basically.
Yes, the number one reason I wouldn't want to live in the past is because how awful the past was to women, especially people who didn't have privilege, you know, the poor, uneducated, you know, people who had just come, you know, 1920s, there were a lot of people who had, you know, survived slavery in the Civil War. So it was not a great time to be a woman in the early 20th century. But even the wealthy, privileged women were still treated like property. So we have a character of Faith who was, you know, needed to marry somebody wealthy who treated her very poorly, and she ran away from him and has now is, you know, seeking sanctuary on this island, which is a fantasy of mine. You know, I just want to get away from the internet, but she wants to get away from a situation where she knows eventually is going to kill her, either kill her spirit or kill her physically. She's married to a dangerous man and needs to get away from him. So she runs away and goes to the island. And that's when our Fae becomes Faith shortly after. Faith gets to the island. She's swept out to sea, and then Faye enters her body and becomes her. So there's a joke in the book about quantum leap. So it's a sort of a quantum leap scenario. So we have Faye's mind and Faith's body trying to blend in and not give away that she's not who everyone thinks she is.
And Faith is actually the woman in the painting that Father Pat was creating, right?
Right, yes.
Because there is a legend associated with her.
Right, so like Florence Martis in Savannah, that's all kinds of local legends in every southern town, every coastal town has some local character who becomes a ghost story or a legend. We have ours in Lexington, Kentucky, quite a few of them. So, yeah, I'm sure a lot of northern towns too, but especially the South tends to be haunted. So we have the story of a woman who died in 1921, fell off the pier into the water and was swept away. And now she's a ghost story. Parents tell their kids to say, be safe in the water. The water's choppy. You can get swept out to sea. You can drown. So she's a warning. But we find out there's much more to her death than we realize.
And in fact, the legend keeps changing as Faith goes back and forth in time,
right?
Because she's altering it. And it's never underlined in a crude way, but you start to notice as you're reading through that the legend is shifting as
yes.
things go along, which is a really nice touch, I thought. So life in 1921, no surprise, it's a bit challenging for Faith. I have to give her credit that she didn't spend all her time whining about her iPhone not working,
yeah.
as so many characters do in other books. But still, it's not an easy thing. You've mentioned some of the problems, but what does she have to learn in order to cope with living suddenly in her grandparents' world?
There's a lot she has to deal with, and I tried to put myself into her shoes, and the basics are food and water and shelter. So I had to think about food is going to be very different in the 1920s. If you're living on an island, you're going to have preserves and stuff that's kind of disgustingly chemically preserved in cans. But also you would have, because food is delivered to the lighthouses, and that was kind of the beginning of a lot of canned foods. But also they'll have a garden that you have to deal with on a daily basis, weeding and whatnot. If you want peach pie in fall, you've got to make sure your trees are pruned in the spring. You have to, if you want, you know, corn in September, you've got to plant it in March. So you have to do a lot of meal planning very, very early. And if you don't, you're going to starve. So, you know, we're also spoiled by just getting to go to the grocery store. Not that I'm complaining about that. I don't have a garden. I don't particularly want one, but my grandparents had one that was a lot of work, and they worked on it every single day, onions and tomatoes and that sort of thing. So she has to do weeding, which is backbreaking work, especially for someone who doesn't do a lot of manual labor in a regular life. She has to deal with heat. You know, as I was thinking about the clothes that somebody would wear a woman would wear in 1920, and even in the height of summer in South Carolina, you would still be wearing long sleeves. Faye has this realization of like, oh, it's sunblock. I have to be covered from head to toe, not out of you know, primness or propriety or modesty. If I will get a sunburn if I do not have my arms covered, and there's no sunblock in this time, and you can get, you know, a horrible sunburn if you don't cover yourself and put on a hat. So, you know, thinking about things in the mind of someone from 1921 instead of from my 2017 mind. Food, water, was rainwater. Coastal lighthouse keepers in that time had rain barrels where they collected rain, and that was their fresh water source mostly. And they had to put chlorine drops in it, so their drinking water tasted like chlorine, which is not very pleasant drinking swimming pool water, but it was better than the alternative, getting dysentery or that sort of thing. So it's a lot of work.
A lot of work, yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't seem, I mean, I guess it's almost 100 years ago now, but even so, I mean, to realize that everything was so much more work. I mean, there were no vacuum cleaners, no washing machines. I mean, just doing basic things to clean, and I mean, it was a constant slog.
Yeah, a book I read, a historic book about that time period, said that the average amount of housework a woman did every week in the 1910s, 1920s was 60 hours of housework. So you couldn't have women working jobs out in the world because their full-time and a half job was just keeping the house from falling down. And it wasn't housework the way we do housework, where we wipe off the counters with, you know, just a wet rag or whatever just to make them shiny. It was you have to clean the ashes off the ceiling lights or they'll catch on fire and burn the house down. You know, it was we have to beat the rugs because there's bugs in them, you know, and the bugs will breed and bite us if we don't beat the rugs every couple of days to get them out. So it was like life and death housework. Not, you know, not just we want our houses to look nice. It was we want our houses to not kill us. So everything, the stakes were much higher back then, too.
Right. So in your story, the person, I mean, Faye does an enormous amount of it as well as she gets you know, as she gets accustomed to living there. But the person who's mostly responsible for doing this is another important character in the book, Dolly.
Yes, I love Dolly. I think she was my favorite one to write.
So tell us about Dolly, because she turns out to, I mean, I don't know that you want to say what the connections are, but she turns out to have present-day connections as well.
So we have a lot of lighthouse keepers had big families, and the Lighthouse Bureau liked to have lighthouse keepers who had big families because everybody worked. So the more people in the family at the lighthouse, the more backup help you had. If the lighthouse keeper fell and broke his leg, which was common, that sort of thing happened when you're carrying, you know, oil drums up 100 stairs five times a day. You know, lighthouse keepers got hurt and they got sick and their wife or their kids would have to take over. But Carrick is a single guy, so he needs help. So he has Dolly, his housekeeper, who is a black teenager. And she is the daughter of a fisherman who lives on one of the sea islands out there, which was very common in the time. I read about the coastal area was all black people on the islands, and the only white people were the lighthouse keeper families. That's it in that time. So I had this moment where I was like, well, you've got to have – it's South Carolina. She's probably going to be black, but she's also this incredibly talented sort of Martha Stewart type housekeeper. She can do anything. She can make her own clothes. She's a seamstress. She's an interior decorator. So she was turned into this teenage Martha Stewart, which I have a cousin who's like that and always impressed and amazed me. So it was like the art of housekeeping. So it's not this, I have Dolly. She's not, housekeeping is not drudgery to her. She's turned it into this high art because 17-year-olds in 1920s could do a lot of that stuff that are lost skills now, sewing and cooking without recipes, that sort of thing. You know, she had a lot of skills that are lost to most teenagers now who don't have to do that sort of stuff. So it was a lot of fun to show basically to show Faye's like, Faye, you are useless. You 2015 woman, you are useless in 1921. You don't even know how to bake a pie in an oven that doesn't have all the buttons and the gauges on it that you're used to. So this teenage girl is going to show you how it's done.
And she has a disability. She can't hear.
Right. She's deaf. That was just something that occurred to me. You know, this is a warning of how tough life is in 1921. In the early 20th century, if a baby gets a fever, you're going to be very lucky if the baby lives. And if the baby does live, there's a good chance that the child will end up with health problems. So when I was looking up Helen Keller, they said Helen Keller went deaf and blind. And I think one of the theories, because they didn't know, they didn't have modern medicine. They called it a brain fever. She had a brain fever. She had scarlet fever, which they don't think that's what it was anymore. So it's completely, if you go back to 1921, you're going to see a lot more amputees. You would see a lot more people with diseases. You would see a lot more blind people or deaf people because, you know, they... without antibiotics, a cold could do terrible things to you. But it's much more common then, so everybody just sort of treats her like it's normal.
So this brings me to another question, which is, what kinds of research did you have to do for this novel? And do you have time to fit in research when you're writing 4 books a year? That's a lot.
I can't remember which. I want to say it was Stephen King who said research as you go. And that way you're only researching what you need to know. Because if you want to just sit down and read books about the 1920s and lighthouses in the United States, that you could spend 10 years reading every published book about how lighthouses worked and work and what the 1920s in America was like. Several books just on the year 1927 alone. Instead of just sitting down and reading, I started writing the story. And when I got to the past that I would look stuff up, it was like, okay, so we know in 1921 there was electricity, but was there electricity on these coastal islands? Not really, but what was there? So a lot of lighthouses were gas powered. Well, a lot of houses were gas powered still in the 1920s. So we have a house that's run on gas instead of run on electricity. So that's much more plausible. And I looked up some of the fun, i.e. horrific accidents that having a gas powered lighthouse happened in the past, and gas in the house, like you have to clean your lampshades very carefully because then, you know, if you have too much soot on them, they could catch on fire. So little things like that. I just researched as I went. But I went to Beaufort, South Carolina. I climbed the Hunting Island Lighthouse. I went to anytime I was anywhere within 50 miles of a lighthouse, I would drive there and walk around the lighthouse. I was living in Oregon at the time, so I went to a bunch of lighthouses on the in the Pacific Northwest, which are very different sorts of lighthouses than in the South. But collecting their stories, what their furniture and their houses look like, and what the Fresnel lenses look like, it was a lot of fun. So a lot of it was hands-on research, but a lot of it was just reading as I went.
Yeah, I think that probably helps with the other problem with historical fiction in particular. There's a tendency to information dump. If you've done all this research, you want to put it all in the story, and it doesn't necessarily belong there.
Exactly. It can really bog it down.
So what would you like readers to take away from The Night Mark?
Well, it's a story of second chances and a story of hope, ultimately. The idea that someone out there loves us, is taking care of us, and is little by little mending all the heartaches. Which is a very religious idea, but I'm a religious person, and I would like to think that ultimately we will all get our chance to have our the holes in our life mended by someone who's taking care of us and sees the grand scheme of things. So it's as Father Pat says, Faye is sort of a modern female Job who's lost everything, and by the end she gets it all back, because I'm ultimately an optimist, but in a different way, a way she didn't expect, in a way that requires her to be brave and courageous and make some hard choices, which we all have to do if we want to achieve happiness. We have to be brave because it can be very scary going after it. But it's a story of hope and the fundamental decency of the people out there who are keeping watch over us, like lighthouse keepers.
That's lovely. It's a lovely message. This book has just come out, but because you have to eat, I assume you're working on something else already.
Every day, working on something, every day.
Or perhaps even something since, I mean, this has been in production for a while, I assume. What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm working on, it's a book that tentatively titled The Lucky Ones. It'll be set on the Oregon coast, because that's close to where I used to live. And it's a nice, spooky, gothic sort of setting. It's very cloudy and dramatic out on the Oregon coast, very cold water. So it's another water book. I wanted to write something. I call it V.C. Andrews and Madeline Lingle had a book baby that grew up and moved to the Oregon coast. So that'll be out next February. A young woman who was in an unusual foster family when she was a child and has not seen them in about 13 or 14 years gets invited back to this unusual foster family. And when the patriarch of the family is dying, they want to see her again before he passes away. And she returns and discovers a lot of secrets about her time there and about the other children in the family, the dark secrets behind why they're such wonderful people. It's very gothic, and has been a lot of fun to write. So I'm doing edits on that right now. So that should be out in February of next year. And then I have a very naughty book coming out in July because I will never get completely away from my erotic romance roots. It's called The Red. That comes out this year, and The Lucky Ones comes out next year.
That's great. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For sharing your time with us today. I really appreciated talking with you.
I had a great time. Thanks for having me, and I hope everyone goes out and reads The Night Mark.
Yes, absolutely. Go and buy it.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been speaking with Tiffany Rice about The Night Mark. You can find out more about her at www.tiffanyrice.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction. And follow us on Twitter at UBooksHistFic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can also find out more about me, my website, and my books at blog.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about new books in historical fiction.